Good afternoon, and thank you for coming to this afternoon's Michigan Writers Series presentation. I'm Agnes Witter, and I'm the person who suggested that we ask John Waller to speak today. I'm the subject selector here in the libraries for the British Isles and France and the Middle Ages and religious studies. And so his things are of interest to me, even though they're in the history of science, because of the countries and the time periods he writes about. The Michigan Writers Series, why do we have it? It's author talks by writers that live here in Michigan, and we do it to promote the library, to promote our services and collections, and to encourage the culture of books and reading in our community. MSU, because of its land-grantiness background, originally came into existence to teach courses in the sciences, agriculture, engineering, domestic science, and a smattering of liberal arts. So the original role of the MSU libraries was to collect in these subjects. And our special collections, which I have a role in working there, has a very strong collection about agriculture, natural history, veterinary medicine, cookery and food, as well as the long 18th century radicalism, popular culture, and comic art, which are the collections that these days are really much more used. But we have a lot of really old, great stuff in the sciences, which would form the primary source material that people like Professor Waller would use to write their books. We offer access to a database called HSTM, that stands for the History of Science, Technology, and Medicine, which is the major index to scholarly literature in the field of the history of science, technology, and medicine. We have a large set of first editions of scientific works in microcards called the Landmarks of Science. It's a very extensive collection. And we also offer access through some of our very large electronic databases like EEBO and ECCO, which are early books in the English-speaking world, things like British Periodicals Collection 1 and 2. So we're offering works in all different subject areas, including, and they will be in the sciences as well as in other fields, and you can get those things online through our electronic resources. Now, the speaker today is Professor Waller here. And this is what it says about him on the website from the History Department. This is Dr. John Waller, Associate Professor of the History of Medicine, who received his BA in Modern History and his Master of Science in Human Biology from the University of Oxford, his Master of Science in the History of Science and Medicine from Imperial College London, and his PhD in the History and Philosophy of Science from University College London in 2001. After he finished his PhD, he was a postdoc at Harvard and a research fellow and a part-time lecturer at University College London. Then he was a lecturer in history and medicine and medicine and biology at the University of Melbourne in Australia. His research has largely focused on 19th century medical science and society. He's the publisher of several books. Einstein's Luck and Leaps in the Dark were put out by Oxford University Press in 02 and 04. That's these two. And these are the library copies. That's because of the black covers, you see. Not very beautiful. Are re-examinations of iconic moments in the histories of science and medicine. Discovery of the Germ, which is this one, put out by Columbia University Press in 04, is a study of the advent of the germ theory of disease. The Real Oliver Twist, Robert Blincoe, A Life That Illuminates an Age, put out by Icon Books in 05, is a social biography which explores the lives of parish apprentices in the early 19th century in England. And that's this. This is his copy. The library has two copies, and both of them are checked out, so I just brought the paper that describes it. A Time to Dance, A Time to Die, which came out from Icon Books in 08, is an account of an epidemic of dancing in the 16th century Holy Roman Empire. The subject headings on that put it in Strasbourg, France, and that is how I knew that he might be an interesting person to have speak, and that is, I think, what sold Michael, who coordinates the series, on asking him, because he thought that would have broad appeal to both people in the science community as well as in the humanities. although I think the other books would also be very interesting to the social science and humanities people. The dancing book in the Middle Ages was shortlisted for something called the Dingle Prize of the British Society for the History of Science. He is currently working on a history of ideas of the innate difference from classical antiquity to the present to do with breeding. The book is going to be called Breeding, A History of Heredity, Sex, and Race, and it's going to come out from Oxford University Press next year. He's also published a number of peer-reviewed articles on the history of heredity, eugenics, Victorian science, and psychic epidemics. He is an editor of a journal, one of an editor's, I'm presuming, called Endeavor, which is on the history of science and medicine. He teaches classes both in the history department and in Lyman Briggs on history of science and history and philosophy of science. Please welcome Dr. Waller.
Okay, thank you, Agnes. Thanks for the invitation. Getting the invitation to speak this afternoon, oh, by the way, thank you for coming. Getting the invitation forced me to think about what kind of writer I am, and it's not something that I've reflected on very much because I've always considered myself to jump around rather a lot and perhaps too much. The books I've done, as Agnes has explained, range from medieval dancing epidemics to reanalyses of iconic moments in the history of science and medicine, social biographies of workhouse apprentices in the early 19th century. What all these books have in common is a desire to take the research of other historians, myself included, and pitch them at a broader audience, to take what I consider to be important and interesting findings, usually with some kind of modern relevance, and then try and convince a broader audience that that is the case. So the books I've done are based on extensive research, but I do my absolute best to make them readable and accessible. So what I want to do in the next half an hour or so is just to give the backstory to three of these books and then give brief readings from them. I'll begin with the first couple of books I did, which are both collections of essays. This is the second one, Leaps in the Dark. This was the first book I did. It was called rather mysteriously Fabulous Science in the UK. The idea was that it was a clever play on the word fabulous. I'm not sure it was very successful, although calling it Einstein's luck was borderline fraudulent because it barely mentions Einstein. That's not quite true. There is a chapter which is largely devoted to him, but still. These two books take a similar approach. They take the received view of an important moment, a discovery in science or medicine, and look to find out how well that received standard story actually relates to what historical scholarship has thrown up. So, for example, this one looks at the first serious attempt to demonstrate the truth of Einstein's general relativity. It looks at Alexander Fleming and the discovery of penicillin. It looks at one of Louis Pasteur's earliest debates, a scientific victory that really set him on his way to become one of the most famous people on the planet in the late 19th century. And it takes these studies and it looks to see what the discrepancy is between how we think science works and how it actually does work. And the point of writing these essays was not muckraking. It was not to bring science down. In fact, it was to argue that we actually get science badly wrong if we think that it's all about these thrilling moments of sudden clarity, these eureka moments where everything is incredibly clear to a few geniuses. Everybody else from that point who disagrees is stupid, and that eventually everybody comes round. Now, let me see if I can work this. Do it this way. What I take on in these books is what I call a three-act drama. And if you read about discovery in the press, science textbooks, the media, they pretty much all stick to this formula. And it really does enormous damage to the integrity of the past to shoehorn scientific discovery into these dramas. They are actually incredibly rare. Well, the first thing is the eureka moment. Archimedes is, of course, the obvious example. where there's this moment of incredible insight, almost as if you were touched by a god, and you suddenly realise what everyone else has been missing. Now, in order to be really ahead of your time, you've got to then experience your wilderness years. It doesn't really matter that much if you're a scientist or if you're a religious leader or maybe a totalitarian dictator. The way people write about you in order to romanticise about you, they'll almost always give you your wilderness years. And then after the wilderness years, there is the third act in this drama, which is the final acclamation, where everybody realises that you were right all along, they all feel rather stupid about themselves, and they finally, usually begrudgingly, agree with you. Now, to be a real hero, ideally you're dead before this happens. Louis Pasteur was sufficiently important. You can see him here getting his accolades on his 80th birthday at the Sorbonne in Paris. He did enough to be recognised within his own lifetime and still be considered a hero. But to be a true romantic genius, ideally you'll die before you get your accolades. Now, what's problematic about this view? It might be actually that this kind of telling of stories in the history of science is good at inspiring people to go into science in the first place. That might be the case. The problem with it, as I see it, is that it means that people don't fully understand what science is like. The real beauty of science is that it's a culture of competition and disagreement. People never agree until finally, in many cases, they reach a point of consensus. That's what makes science so incredibly special. There is no other culture in the world that is based on constructive criticism. Now, the result of telling stories where you've got a single genius, everybody else is too stupid to realise that what they're saying is true, and that finally they are vindicated, is that it simplifies the scientific process. It leads people to think that if scientists are disagreeing, then they don't know what they're talking about. If there's uncertainty in science, it's because the scientific endeavour is somehow flawed. I don't think that there would be quite so much willingness to be sceptical about vaccines or some of the most important biological theories or theories in physics, if it were not for the fact that people mistake disagreement for a flawed endeavour. So what these books try and do is say we ought to have a richer sense of the way that science operates, and it's through disagreement that we actually reach something which approximates the truth. So I'll read you... I'm not going to read much from this book, but I'll just read the first two paragraph to give you a sense of the book. This is my first book, and it's probably the most journalistic. And so looking back, some passages make me cringe slightly. But anyway, this is a taster of it. The great biologist Louis Pasteur suppressed awkward data because it didn't support the case he was making. Gregor Mendel, the supposed founder of genetics, was no Mendelian. Joseph Lister's famously clean wards were actually notoriously dirty. Alexander Fleming misled the world about his role in the discovery of penicillin, and Einstein's general relativity was only confirmed in 1919 because an eminent British scientist ruthlessly massaged his figures. These are some of the recent findings of historians covered in this book. In writing it, my primary aim has been to bring to the attention of a wider audience the fruits of a generation's research into the history of science. But although the scholarship I draw on seriously challenges the reputations of major scientific figures, this is not an exercise in pointless iconoclasm. Above all, this book aims to offer insights into the conduct of scientific debate, the securing of scientific immortality, and the complex interplay between scientists and the worlds in which they operate. The second, the third book I did, Leaps in the Dark, continued this theme, although those Leaps in the Dark tends to be rather more detailed and tells what I think are slightly more subtle and, for me, more interesting stories. The fourth book that I worked on is entitled The Real Oliver Twist, a title I wasn't terribly happy about for a number of reasons, and it generated quite a lot of media interest because of the... one of the suggestions in the book that Charles Dickens may have been inspired by, in writing Oliver Twist, by the life story of the person whose life this book chronicles. I'll leave that aside for one moment. This is from a newspaper review. And like many reviews, it concentrated largely on that issue. Of all the aspects of this guy's life, it was probably the one that actually interested me least. The background of this book is that I was working in London and I was doing some research on the conditions of parish apprentices in the early Industrial Revolution. So looking at the way in which children were treated in the first cotton-spinning mills of the English Industrial Age. And doing some background reading on this, I came across a reference to a memoir about a young boy called Robert Blincoe. Now, the first thing that amazed me was that anybody had actually written a serious biography of a working man in the early 19th century. These, in fact, there are quite a number of biographies of working men, but they nearly all follow the same format. They're mostly written by Protestant evangelicals in the late 19th century, early 19th century. And they talk about the working man growing up amid scenes of dissipation, becoming a drunkard and a fornicator. Then they find God. They go through this personal conversion experience. Then they become extremely evangelical, good people, and they try and spread the word. They're astonishingly tedious, and they're also almost entirely fabricated. So there was a glimpse here, at least, of a genuine working-class biography. That most refreshing thing, history told from the point of view of individual people without power, rather than from the point of view of generals, of statesmen, and society ladies. Now, I went to the British Library and I found a copy of the original Robert Blincoe memoir. And the subtitle basically tells his story. An orphan boy sent from the workhouse of St. Pancras, London, at 7 years of age to endure the horrors of a cotton mill through his infancy and youth, with minute detail of his sufferings, being the first memoir of the kind published. And it really is, as far as I can tell, it is the first serious English working-class biography. And this is it, as it appeared in essentially pamphlet form in 1832, at which point this character became really quite well known. I'll quickly go through his story. This is St. Pancras, the parish north of London where Robert Blincoe was born. I don't know how many of you have been to St. Pancras. It doesn't look like that anymore. In fact, it looks a lot better than it did 10 years ago. They've cleaned it up. It used to be a massively overcrowded, overbuilt, insanitary area of London. This church, remarkably, still survives. These fields are under several feet of concrete and tar and have been for over 100 years. But this is the bucolic part of London where Robert Blincoe was born. He was dumped at a very young age, just up the road from there, at this place, a workhouse. This isn't actually one of the workhouses that Charles Dickens was lambasting in writing Oliver Twist. These were somewhat better. They weren't generally as overcrowded. The workhouses that Dickens wrote about were set at a calculated level of suffering, the idea being it was carefully calibrated. They should be so unpleasant that it would keep you alive, but there would be no incentive to go there rather than doing the cheapest, most degrading job you could possibly find. But this still was insanitary, it was overcrowded, and the children were deprived of any kind of affection. But when he was about seven, he was sold to the owners of a cotton mill in Nottingham, a few hundred kilometres north of London, sent in a cart which was covered in a wooden hood. The children couldn't see where they were going, and they certainly couldn't escape. And this is the surprisingly attractive-looking mill that he went to. This has now been turned into prime real estate. But this is Loudon Mill, where he spent about 2 years of, as I'll read in a moment, pretty shocking treatment. When that mill closed down, he was sent to Lytton Mill. This, as you can kind of see from this image, is nestled in an area of the Peak District. These mills were surrounded by trees and hills. They became the private fiefdoms of the first generation of cotton mill operators. They basically did what they liked in these remote villages. And this is why the conditions in these were usually much worse than those in the later generation of mills in places like Manchester, later all over New England. This is a kind of machinery. These are the kind of conditions in which Blinker worked. This is actually an image from a book by Mary Trollope, who was an incredibly successful Victorian novelist who fell out of fashion fairly fast. This is a book called Michael Armstrong, and it's all about a factory boy. A large part of the book is actually completely ripped off from Blinker's memoir. There's no mention of Blinker in it, but most of the most dramatic scenes are taken straight out of Blinker's life. He was subject at Lytton Mill to the most brutal treatment at the hands of the owner of this house, which is just up the hill from the mill, and also his sons, an extraordinarily pathological family. This I will now come to. I want to just read you a few excerpts from different parts of the book that take you through important moments in his life. The reason I wanted to tell Blinker's story is that I saw it as a way of following an individual's life story in a way that allowed me to describe a broader social landscape of the time. So what the book does is it begins with Blinker and then repeatedly opens out, looking at attempts to improve the conditions in factories, looking at the condition of the working class, looking at popular radicalism at various points in his life. And Blinker's story turned out to be an amazing way of actually telling the story of politics and industry within Britain in the first several decades of the 19th century. But let me just begin with the first chapter, talking about Blinker's life in St. Pancras. Around the year 1792, somewhere in the London parish of St. Pancras, Robert Blinker made his entry into the world. Whether the parish surgeon attended, or a local midwife, or whether his mother delivered him alone in secret, we'll never know. We can be sure, however, that his birth was not the cause of much joy. Of his first few years, Blinker retained only vague impressions, but one thing he perfectly recollected. At the age of four, he was taken in a coach, accompanied by an unknown woman, and left at St. Pancras Workhouse. Blinker was later convinced, on the basis that he recalled no sorrow at their parting, that the woman in the coach bore him no relation. And his patchy memories of his first year suggested to him that he had passed through many hands before he arrived at the workhouse. Who knows what series of wet nurses or impoverished relations he'd been entrusted to before his complete abandonment, or what agonies a desperate mother may have suffered following his birth. There is a hint in Blinker's description of sustained efforts having been made to keep him from the misery of the workhouse. It may also be that in these years he received the balm of a mother's love. His subsequent strength of character certainly suggests that someone had once made him feel treasured and important, but we can do no more than speculate. As a worker's boy, to use Noah Claypole's unendearing term from Dickens's Oliver Twist, Robert Blinker entreated the parish authorities to reveal his mother's identity. Initially, they wouldn't even tell him his full name. 15 or so years later, he received official papers stating that he'd been christened Robert Blinker. While he vaguely remembered hearing the name Robert applied to himself at the workhouse, his surname came as a complete revelation. Why the parochial officials were so chary in divulging this detail is a mystery. Perhaps they were simply blind to a workhouse boy's need to feel connected. Maybe they thought it best that he put all such thoughts out of his mind. It's just about possible that they were protecting the reputation of a respectable parishioner. It's far more likely, however, that they had no reason beyond bureaucratic indifference. Blinker was a mere ward of the parish, and as such, his private woes were beneath their dignity. The only parents he knew or would ever know were the master and mistress of the parish workhouse, and as far as the parish authorities were concerned, he deserved no better. But the tongues of the resident nurses were less strictly governed. Workhouse nurses were typically not much better off than their wards. One reliable observer called them indigent, filthy, and decrepit.
They usually slept in the inmates' beds and followed the same grinding routine. But they were often privy to parish secrets and always keen purveyors of rumours and gossip. One of these nurses informed Blinko that soon after his arrival, an anonymous female had inquired after him by the name of Saint. She had then left a penny piece and informed him that his mother had passed away. She apparently gave no information as to the circumstances. Although Blinko heard nothing more of his parentage, up until his 21st birthday, he went either by the nickname Saint or more commonly Parson. This appellation was enough to feed the workhouse rumour mill, for didn't it imply that Blinko, as his later biographer put it, owed his existence to the mutual frailties of his mother and a reverend divine. So that's all we know about Blinko's start in life. Let me add a little bit more about his years in the workhouse. And these were incredibly desolate years in Blinko's life. And he did everything to get out. In fact, one of the most remarkable passages in the memoir is where it describes him desperately wanting to be apprenticed by a master sweep. And, of course, in Dickens, it's Oliver goes to any length to avoid getting apprenticed to the master sweep. For Blinko, this is an opportunity to get out of the workhouse and possibly to track down his parents. He fails. He was simply too small and weak to do the job. Well, this is a continuation of a description of his workhouse years. The workhouse gossips were probably right in thinking that Blinko's mother never married. This would account for his never having been visited or adopted by an extended family, and why rumour coalesced around his paternity. So from the moment of his birth, Robert Blinko was mired in shame, the guilty outcome of an act that in the eyes of the respectable could only be redeemed by matrimony. Many of Blinko's contemporaries assumed that a child born of unholy lust would be already corrupted by its parent's sin. Hence, during a parliamentary debate on the savage abuse of young chimney sweeps, one noble lord said that they deserved no protection, since so many of them were, to quote, children of rich men begotten in an improper manner. The bastard bore a lifelong curse. Unless the acknowledged result of a liaison between unmarried aristocrats, he or she was morally compromised from conception on. They lived in a state of chronic infamy, the burden of guilt increasing in proportion to their poverty. Not surprisingly, bastards died at twice the rate of the legitimate. Pitifully poor and a presumed bastard, Blinko was to carry a heavy burden of stigma. But he was just one among thousands of poor illegitimates thrown because of parental mortality, immorality or misfortune onto the meagre charity of the parish during the 1700s. His mother might have been a prostitute, the victim of rapacious lust, the dupe of an amorous neighbour, or a fallen lady of decent birth. We'll never know the truth. What matters is that her son had been stigmatised as illegitimate and abandoned by whatever family still lived. Thereby, Robert Blinko was condemned to a childhood, a profound emotional emptiness and economic exploitation. In the handful of passages devoted to Blinko's workhouse years in his memoir, the depth of his childhood suffering occasionally breaks through John Brown, the author of the memoir, John Brown's verbosity. In narrating his early life to Brown, Blinko recalled with fresh pain the occasions on which the family members of the other workhouse children, mainly parents unable to afford to care for their children themselves, were permitted to enter the workhouse gate to embrace their offspring. Never was Blinko's name called out, though he presumably remained in hope of a visit for many months. For years after, he stood by as his peers rushed excitedly to the meeting room. It was a gruelling ritual for the parish orphan. When the friends, relatives, parents of other children came to visit them, the memoir explained, the caresses that were sometimes exchanged, the joy that beamed on the faces of those so favoured, went as daggers to my heart. We don't know if Blinko really used this expression, but it was surely an apt description of the extreme loneliness he felt at this time. Well, sometime after this, the workhouse was contacted by the owners of this spinning mill. And I'll just tell you a little bit about that, because the circumstances in which the children were induced to go willingly to this mill, were one of the things that really struck me, first of all, about this story. In early summer 1799, another rumour reached Blinko's ears. It inspired him with new life and spirits. The church wardens and overseers were apparently in talks with the owner of a great cotton factory in the vicinity of Nottingham, who needed plenty of young apprentices. A certain Mr. William Lambert, resident of Southampton Place, a few hundred yards south of the workhouse, had made contact with the parish authorities on behalf of two of his relations, William Charles and Francis Lambert. They were the proprietors of a cotton and hosiery mill on the banks of the Dover Beck in Lowdham village, a few miles outside Nottingham. They needed a child apprentices. William had agreed to use his local collections to procure some from the St. Pancras authorities. Now, this was very regular practice at the time, to get workhouse orphans to work in these early mills. You didn't need to pay them very much. They couldn't run away. They had nowhere to go. And also, they had small fingers, which were very useful in operating the machinery. Well, it may be that reports of the cruelty of certain cotton masters had not penetrated the closed world of the workhouse. But as the overtures of the Lamberts became public knowledge, children and parents must have felt some foreboding at the prospect of their children being sent hundreds of miles from the parish. So in order to appease gullible adults and to enthuse the workhouse children, the overseers resorted to an expedient of the most brazen cynicism. The children were unblushingly told that upon arrival at the Lamberts cotton mill, they would be transformed into ladies and gentlemen. The lie was perfectly tailored to the limited knowledge and experience of the workhouse children. As the memoir records, they were informed that, to quote, they would be fed on roast beef and plum pudding, be allowed to ride their master's horses and have silver watches and plenty of cash in their pockets. It was consummately done. Within their limited frame of reference, here were all the embodiments of comfort, wealth and refinement. I'll skip a little bit. It may seem surprising that Robert Blinko and the other workhouse children fell for such wildly improbable promises. That they did so speaks of their intense need to believe that life had more to offer them than the meaningless existence they'd so far endured. It was a case of hope triumphing over experience. Who actually sold them the false prospectus, we don't know. The overseers and William Lambert were certainly involved, and they perhaps put some of the nurses up to disseminating the falsehoods. Either way, it's clear that the practice of promising workhouse children wealth and status was not unique to St. Pancras. John Brown, Blinko's biographer, was aware of many similar cases. A certain orphan John of Bethnal Green Workhouse later wrote in the Ashington Chronicle of how he had been told by parish officers that if he agreed to go to a Derbyshire cotton mill, he would have fine sport among the hills, abundant time for play and pleasure, plenty of roast beef and money, that he would come back a seasoned gentleman. It was a tried and tested ruse. In fact, these children, until effective legislation was passed in the 1830s, typically worked 15, 16, sometimes 17-hour days on diets which were woefully inadequate, and they died at very, very high rates, particularly at places like Lytton Mill. Now, at Lowdham Mill, Blinko was subjected to pretty horrendous treatment, but this was nothing compared to what was inflicted on him at Lytton Mill. This is almost certainly the nastiest of all the cotton mills of the early industrial age. So I'm just going to read a little bit about the kind of treatment that Blinko was subjected to. I'll say a little bit later something about how we can corroborate what happened. As a roving winder, this was his job. Blinko had struggled to keep up at Lowdham. But here at Lytton Mill, the slivers, that's the lengths of a relatively unprocessed cotton, were passed through the rollers of the spinning machine at an even greater speed. Over and over again, he fell behind. The children's chaperone on the journey from Nottingham had been Robert Woodward, their governor at Lowdham. Now an overlooker at this mill, he noticed Blinko's difficulties and struck the boy to the ground with a heavy, open-handed blow. The brutality of Robert and his brother William was to be one of the constant features of the next decade of Blinko's existence. Seldom was there a let-up. Blinko couldn't say how often he was beaten. He simply remarked that for 10 years his body was never free from contusions and from wounds inflicted by the cruel master whom he served, by his sons or his brutal and ferocious and merciless overlookers. Blinko doesn't give us much in the way of narrative for Blinko's stay at Lytton Mill. Instead, he provides a detailed and horrifying litany of the sadistic cruelties practiced. There must have been days when even Robert Woodward left the boys alone. But the abuse was constant enough to make Blinko's life all but intolerable. In these years, he began rueing the day on which he'd been taken to Dr. Woodville's smallpox hospital to inoculate it. He spoke of wishing that he had died. He became prey to profound depression. This is hardly surprising. The memoir describes how Robert Woodward would kick him into the air, floor him with slaps and punches, or thrash him with sticks and rope ends. The overlookers, Brown heard, exulted in these barbaric displays of their arbitrary power. They gathered around, laughingly tormenting Blinko and the other victims. Both Blinko and Orphan John spoke of many different sadistic practices. If they were too slow, clumsy, or even just happened to be there, the apprentices were flogged with belts, the metal bottles cutting into flesh. They had heavy metal rollers hurled at their heads, occasionally cracking against skulls and causing bleeding, bruising and severe swelling. They were lifted up by the ears and hurled to the ground, having been shaken violently. They were forced to eat dirty pieces of candle and tobacco spittle to open their mouths for the overlookers to spit into. They had sharp nails dug into their earlobes. They were tricked into eating tar, thinking they'd been given treacle. They even had their teeth filed so that, laughed Robert Woodward, they might eat their Sunday dinner the better. A favourite trick was to hang weights from children's shoulders and then insist that they work encumbered for the rest of the day. Another involved screwing hand vices weighing a pound apiece to children's ears. Such cruelty left permanent scars. In 1833, Blinko revealed to one of His Majesty's commissioners the heavy lines of scarring behind each ear, where fingernails and small vices had punctured and gripped. John Brown, too, noted these mutilations. Blinko identified Robert Woodward as the most savage of his tormentors, but two others, Merrick and Charnock, were willing sidekicks. The three appear to have taken pride in their malicious ingenuity. Lytton Mill had spinning machines rather than the mules devised by Samuel Crompton in 1799, and Woodward devised several techniques of abuse involving them. Blinko repeatedly had his arms strapped. Let me actually show you an image of these. These are somewhat similar. Blinko repeatedly had his arms strapped to the crossbar running over the mules so that his legs dangled down into the path of the carriage as it was first drawn away from the wall and soon after pushed back by the spinner. So he would be stretched up here in somewhat more primitive machines. And then, so he would be dangling down here and had to continually remove his legs, otherwise he would have them lacerated. Each time the frame moved outwards and then returned, Blinko had to raise his legs. If he didn't, he would receive severe bruises or broken bones from the heavy carriage and its row of fast-turning spindles. His abusers ensured that harm was always done by beating him around the shins. At other times, Blinko was sent beneath a mule to clear away waste cotton. To avoid serious injury from the carriage returning after a draw, this was a job to be done little by little, the child removing a little bit of waste cotton on each time it came out. On one occasion, Blinko was told to clear all the cotton waste in a single draw, so he'd have to go all the way from here to somewhere like that before he could escape from the machine. With the alternative of severe drubbing from Woodward and his associates, he swung under as soon as the carriage moved outwards and frantically pushed the cotton before him, hoping to exit the other side before the returning carriage trapped him inside. He wasn't quick enough. His head became jammed between the carriage and the headpiece, tearing skin and rupturing blood vessels. Unrepentant, Woodward thrashed him and bid him return to his work. Now, what's remarkable and unusual about Blinko is that he refuses to accept this treatment. And on three separate occasions, he escapes from this valley and he tries to find magistrates who he can tell about the appalling treatment that these children are being subjected to. So I just want to read one more passage. Blinko has escaped. He's come back with the magistrates essentially telling him that he's on his own and that he's got no right to complain. And he's beaten almost to death at this point. And for several days, he's so badly beaten that he's unable to leave his bed. He gives it one last try. And this speaks volumes for the strength of the guy's character. In agony, Blinko limped back to his spinning machine, scarcely able to stand and covered with additional bruises from head to foot. Escaping again wasn't going to be easy. In response to his truancy, security measures at the mill were tightened up. Roll calls were taken at every dinner time in the apprentice house. The mill gates locked when the journeyman had left for the night. Blinko was in any case too sore to travel any distance. It took 4 days for him to recover sufficiently from the blows he'd received to put into action a new plan. Blinko knew that unless he managed to pull the wrath of the magistrates upon John and Ellis's heads, then he would go on suffering grievously for seeking help. He could be certain that further retribution was to come. So on Sunday night, he stealthily followed the journeymen as they approached the gates on their way home. Crouching low, he then rushed out unseen by the warder. Within minutes, the roll call was underway and Blinko's absence was noted. But the door warder insisted that he hadn't escaped through the main gate. A general search began of the mill and its grounds. This was what Blinko had hoped for, and he now made good his escape. He climbed up the hill, arrived at Lytton Village, the village just above this valley, and then he called at the house of Joseph Robinson, the mill's humane joiner. Robinson spared him some supper, allowed him to sleep in the same bed as his sons, and in the morning gave him some bread and meat. Blinko promised never to reveal the identity of his benefactor, and then he set off for Leam Hall, which was the home of one of the few magistrates who showed some signs of sympathy. It was raining, and Blinko recalled in his memoir how he had struggled through the wet with neither hat nor coat. The walk took him through the village of Eam. This is actually what used to be the pub where he went first to try and plead his case in the village of Eam. This is, on the left here, is some of the countryside. It's actually spectacularly beautiful up there. He headed directly north alongside the fast-flowing River Derwent. After walking for about 7 miles, Blinko saw high up to the left of the river, through the groves of trees that lined the banks, the outline of Leam Hall. An elegant bay window looked down towards the valley, and a venerable spread of ivy covered much of the hall's exterior. With trepidation and tired limbs, Blinko approached its pillared entrance. This is the house today, with amazingly tacky plastic furniture sitting outside it, but it's virtually untouched since the early 19th century. By the time he arrived there, the rain was beating down. Knocking at the door, Blinko was admitted by a manservant and ordered to wait. It wasn't yet time for squires to arise. Some minutes later, Marmaduke Middleton finally appeared. Blinko deferentially approached, to quote, crawling like a spaniel dog, and said, his lines no doubt rehearsed much of the way there, "Sir, I have come again. Mr. Needham has been beating me worse than ever, as soon as he read your letter over." Now, if it happened, as Blinko later told the story, it was artfully done. For all his fawning deference, he had left Middleton with the unpleasant feeling that his own explicit instructions had been casually ignored by a mere manufacturer. Blinko's insubordination now seemed far less brazen. The Needhams were the ones requiring a stern reminder of their place in the social hierarchy. Noticing the boy's wretched state, Middleton told him to go into the kitchen and rest. He then added, "You should not have come here first. You should have gone to Mr. Cheek of Whetstone Hall, and he would have given you a summons." Confused by the magistrate's talk of protocol, Blinko realised that this was likely to turn into a fool's errand, and he'd gambled much on success. "Sir," he began, emboldened by desperation, "he will do naught for me. He is so thick with my master. They are often drinking together." "Nonsense," responded Middleton. "He must listen to you." But a man of the world, Middleton took the precaution of writing a letter to the attorney. Blinko gratefully seized the parchment, gorged himself on bread and cheese from the magistrate's extensive larder, then set off on a 12-mile hike through the now driving rain to Whetstone Hall. Having arrived there, cold, drenched and hungry, Blinker was surprised to see a familiar face. Sally Oldfield's husband had been governor of the apprentice house at Lytton. He was now dead and his widow worked for Shaw and Cheek, the lawyers, as a housekeeper. "Parson, what do you want here?" she said suspiciously. "I have a letter from Mr. Middleton to Mr. Cheek," was his reply. Catching on quickly, Sally recoiled. "Are you going against your master?" Blinko told her of the savage ill-treatment he and others had received, none of which could have surprised her. Sally was impassive. All that mattered was that this was a paltry workhouse apprentice. He was committing a sin for which there could never be any justification. "Hey," Sally exclaimed, "thou should never go against thy master." Further debate was futile. But not entirely cold-hearted, she plied him with bread, cheese and beer from her employer's larder, repeating her inviolable rule, "Parson, thou must never go against thy master." She then bid him wait. Several hours later, Blinko still sat in the kitchen of Whetstone Hall, waiting. No one spoke to him and no mention was made of the letter he had brought from Marmaduke Middleton. In all likelihood, Cheek was in Tideswell, where he did most of his business. But having been betrayed, as Blinko now realised, by the St Pancras parish officials, then by the Lamberts and the Needhams, he was quick to feel the victim of a ruse. Doubting that the magistrate was serious or that Cheek would ever renege on his own client, he left the kitchen, let himself out, then walked 4 or so miles back to the mill. Back at Lytton, Blinko played an intelligent hand. His mission had been a disaster, and John Needham's fury promised to be lethal in its intensity. But he went straight up to William Woodward, told him that he'd been to see the magistrate and an attorney, and said that he would agree not to take formal legal action if Woodward guaranteed that he would receive no further beatings. "On these conditions," Woodward apparently said, "I will if I can." And between then and the end of his period of apprenticeship in 1813, Blinko said that he was spared the rod. Other children were thrashed with impunity, but his courage had won him a reprieve. A young man who had traversed much of the High Peak in search of redress was deserving of respect. And the overlookers no doubt realised that if legal action were taken for the ill-treatment of apprentices, the iron fist of the law would fall heaviest on themselves and not on the owners. Okay. Blinko's story is really quite remarkable. He eventually left the mill. He set up on his own as a cotton spinner with only one employee, and he was a man who'd been crippled in another factory. Unfortunately, soon after setting up his own... He rented mill equipment in a large Manchester mill. A fire broke out and destroyed everything he owned. He was ruined and he ended up bankrupt in debtor's jail in a castle in Lancashire. This is actually one of the rooms he would have been very familiar with. But he came out of this. He married. He had a number of children. He managed to do well enough in business to set up a grocery with the help of his wife. He married in his late 20s. They actually managed to achieve middle-class respectability on the lower end, but nonetheless, they did fairly well for themselves. He earned enough money to send his son to a fairly decent school. Then he was accepted into Manchester Grammar School. Possibly the most extraordinary thing of all in Blinko's story is that his son ended up going to Cambridge University and becoming a well-respected priest. To go from an illegitimate parish orphan in one generation to a Cambridge-educated priest in the next is almost unheard of. And when I started researching this story, I had absolutely no idea of this dimension of the family saga. Now, one of the most exciting things about writing the story of Blinko was that it proved possible to follow his life from where the memoir, written when he was about 35, from where that finished. I was able to take him all the way through to his death and also follow the careers of 3 of his children. What made this possible were a number of sources, but the fact that it was possible to track down surviving members of the Blinko family. And it turned out that they had only known for a few years who the Blinko, in some of their family correspondence and photographs and papers, actually was. And they connected it to a guy that one of the family members had heard studying economics at university, because there was a time when the Blinko's memoir
was read by economists discussing how bad the early cotton mills were. And this is a photograph of Robert Blinko a few years before his death, and I think it's a fascinating image. You can just see the effects of malnutrition on a young body. This is a guy who was basically fed nothing but water porridge for the first, from the age of about 7 till 17. Incredibly narrow shoulders. I think it's very interesting that this is a photograph taken with a technique, meaning that you had to sit there very, very still for some moments. And I think it's a kind of reflex. He's put his hand up to his ear and then he's kept it there. And I suspect he did that quite often because there were reports of scars covering his ears. And I suspect he, once he achieved middle-class respectability, he didn't tell many people about his past. In fact, most of his descendants knew nothing about his workhouse years. It was simply too shameful for people who were trying to rise into the upper middle classes. But it was an absolute joy being able to find so much corroboratory evidence for this guy's life story, not least because a number of certain kinds of economists had tried to argue that his story was largely fabricated for purely political purposes. And this speaks volumes about a certain aspect of English Victorian society. This is father and son at roughly the same time. This is a son who's been to Cambridge and is at the very, very peak of his career. He just exudes confidence. None of the diffidence and awkwardness that you can detect in his father's image. You can't leave the workhouse years behind. At the same time, there's another aspect of Victorian England which is beautifully summarised by this story. Robert Blinko the Younger went to his grave feeling that he'd been cheated out of proper ecclesiastical preferments because he didn't have wealthy family members. And it's almost certainly the case that he was held back because of the nature of his ancestry. Even if they didn't know that his father had been illegitimate, they knew very well that at most he was a reasonably well-off manufacturer. So in all sorts of ways, social mobility was constrained as well as made possible in Victorian Britain. The most interesting thing in the cache of papers, though, was the image of a crest, a coat of arms of the Hyde family. He married a young woman whose family claimed descent from an aristocratic family. Absolute nonsense. There's simply no basis. It's just a coincidence of names in these two lineages. But what's so striking and so illustrative of mindsets in the late 19th century is how, rather than feeling proud of a father who'd come from nothing to a level of respectability, he clung on to this completely apocryphal belief that he had married into an aristocratic family. There's something tragic but very telling about it. So that's the story of Robert Blinko. Let me just, time's getting on, let me just say a few things about one last book, and this is the one I've most recently published. This book also arose out of a chance discovery while reading about something else. For a number of years, I taught the history of psychiatry, and one of the things that is often mentioned in histories of psychiatry, of mental illness in the Middle Ages, are the dancing epidemics. And I was immediately struck. This is a rather unusual concept. And I assumed at first that this must be untrue, that this is medieval chroniclers getting carried away. They were inclined to do so. And so I started looking in more and more detail. What immediately became obvious is that there really genuinely were epidemics of dancing. From the mid to late 1300s onwards, and then they die out around about the first few decades of the 16th century. So what I decided to do was try and recapture a very, very strange period of time, and also to try and explain what could possibly have induced, in some cases, hundreds of people to dance for days, in some cases, weeks. And in the case of the story I looked at, some of them almost certainly danced themselves to death. So let me I'll just begin by reading the first couple of pages of this book. 14th of July, 1518. Somewhere amid the narrow lanes, the congested wharves, the stables, workshops, forges and fairs of the medieval city of Strasbourg, Frau Trophia stepped outside and began to dance. So far as we can tell, no music was playing and she showed no signs of joy as her skirts flew up around her rapidly moving legs. To the consternation of her husband, she went on dancing throughout the day. And as the shadows lengthened and the sun set behind the city's half-timbered houses, it became clear that Frau Trophia simply could not stop. Only after many hours of crazed motion did she collapse from exhaustion. Bathed in sweat and with muscles twitching, she finally sank into a brief restorative sleep. Then, a few hours later, she resumed her solitary jig. Through much of the following day, she went on, fatigue rendering her movements increasingly violent and erratic. Once again, exhaustion prevailed and a weary sleep took hold. On the third day, Frau Trophia rose to bruised and bloody feet and returned to her dance. By now, one contemporary recorded, dozens of onlookers had gathered, drawn by the sheer oddness of this remorseless spectacle. Tradesmen, artisans, porters, hawkers, cripples and ragged beggars jostled with pilgrims, priests, monks and nuns and proud members of the patriciate, nobles set apart by their jewels, demeanour and sumptuous robes, and the wealthier burghers sporting fur-trimmed gowns and expansive turbans of folded silk. They watched as Frau Trophia's dance went on deep into the third day, her shoes now soaked with blood, sweat trickling down her careworn face. Speculations flew among the onlookers. We're told that some blamed restless spirits, demons that had infiltrated and commandeered her soul. Perhaps through sin, they said, she'd weakened her ability to resist the devil's powers. But the crowd soon decided that this affliction had been sent from heaven rather than hell. Accordingly, after several days of violent exertion, Frau Trophia was bundled onto a wagon and transported to a shrine that lay a day's ride away, high up in the Vosges Mountains. If the authorities imagined that the divine rage had now been quelled, they were quickly disabused. I don't want to give too much away, because if I don't tell you much, there's a chance you'll buy the book. But what the book does is explains the mindsets of early 16th century France and Germany as a way of explaining how it was possible for people to slip into a mental state in which they felt they had to dance and dance for many, many days in succession. One of the most unusual things about the story is what the authorities did in response. Once they had about 30, 40 people dancing compulsively, they collected them up, they built a stage over here, they took them into the corn market here, and they made them dance and dance in the open. They even hired dancers and musicians to make sure they stayed on their feet. This is during the punishing heat of a Strasbourg summer. This is why people started to die. Eventually, they stopped doing that, and they took them to this shrine high up in the Vosges Mountains, dedicated to the saint they thought was causing the affliction. And one of the curious parts of this story is that they made them wear red shoes as they danced around the shrine. And this remains somewhat mysterious why they had them do that. So I'll leave that book there and then just briefly mention the book I'm trying to complete at the moment, which is a history of what I consider to be one of the most fundamental ideas in Western thought, that people are different by birth, whether one individual from another, one class from another, or one race from another. These ideas have been incredibly powerful and prevalent. They've also, of course, been astonishingly dangerous and destructive. This book charts the development of these ideas, starting with the ancient Greeks and coming up to close to the present, to talk about how these ideas arose and what circumstances they flourished in. OK, but I'll leave it there. So thank you for your time and your attention.
questions?
Yes, absolutely. Sorry, yes, I've talked a bit too long, but any questions I'm more than happy to answer. Yeah?
Do you think the dancing epidemic to ergot?
My hunch going into this was that ergot was a good explanation. I spent some time looking into it. I consulted a number of neuroscientists. The ergot explanation won't work. There's absolutely no way that that many people could have responded in the same way to ergot poisoning. And ergot poisoning, even when it has psychotropic manifestations, is very unlikely to make you do something that elaborate. Most of the time, actually, people would be almost catatonic with depression. But almost certainly, because of the ergot, I should say, for anybody who doesn't know, is a mold that grows on ripening wheat, particularly in damp conditions, and it can cause gangrene, just appalling, excruciating pain. You'd lose limbs, often you would die, or it can have a more psychotropic effect. But it's very unlikely that people would be able to dance for that long. Through ergot. So, yeah, I thought there might be a nice, neat biological explanation. In fact, I think it doesn't work, but the social, cultural, psychological explanation, I think, is rather more interesting in this case and far more plausible. Yeah.
It seems to me if you were transported back to the 17th century, you would have been a Londoner. Especially the pieces you chose to read were about the cruelty of the class system, the brutality of the people in Strasbourg, the fame grabbing of certain scientists.
Mm. Yeah.
And I wonder, is this a theme that continues in breeding?
Yeah, I would say that it's probably the fundamental theme that runs through all of these. A very, very strong preference for the underdog. I'm not sure I'd go so far as levelling. There's probably a deep cynicism about what makes humans tick, I think, runs through these books. So there's very little optimism. And one of the things I was very keen to do with the Real Oliver Twist book is to point out that there's really no reason to derive any sense of uplift from the fact that Robert Blinko succeeded. The fact that he succeeded, in my view, draws attention to the tens of thousands who failed, because they didn't have his level of self-belief. They also didn't have his level of good fortune. They simply faded away. So, there's a cynicism and a levelling sensibility that runs through these. It's quite right. Yeah.
Could you say a few words about the publication history of the Blinko memoir? Because it seems to me remarkable that he succeeded, as that his story would be publicly available.
Yeah, what happened, it was originally published by leading working-class radicals of the 1820s. There was a journal called The Lion, and basically it was a series of attacks on mill owners in northern England. It would expose them for their ill treatment of apprentices, adult operatives and so forth. And it was part of a general campaign to reform working practices, to improve conditions for adults and children. And so they wanted a poster boy, and they got him. He was perfect for their story. Then it was republished by a man called Richard Carlyle, who was one of the great writers and orators of the of early working-class radicalism in Britain. Then Blinko became almost ubiquitous in left-leaning accounts of factory conditions throughout the 19th century and into the early 20th century. If anybody wanted to talk about that first brutal stage of industrial revolution, they would refer to Robert Blinko. So, and he was aware of this. I mean, in his own lifetime, he knew that he was being repeatedly discussed in these indictments of the early industrial age. Things went somewhat quiet in the middle part of the 20th century. And then post-Second World War, in an incredibly politicised Britain, where you've got free market capitalists fighting against supporters of the unions, he becomes an important bargaining counter in this debate, where people are arguing over how realistic a story Blinko tells in his memoir. And so there was actually a reprint of the memoir, and at least for maybe 2 or 3 years, economics students in a number of British universities read a modern facsimile of the memoir, which is quite remarkable. And then that debate, people got bored with it, they moved on to other things. It was never really resolved, and then again, Blinko just faded from view. So it is remarkable the story keeps coming back. But there hadn't been, there'd never been a biography of him, nor one that actually followed him through for his whole life, or actually attempted to corroborate that. I don't want to go into detail now, but an amazing number of the details in this book, through archival research, I was able to show that they'd happened exactly as he said they did. An astonishing level of honesty in his memoir.
Where,
which one's that? The
original manuscript cover.
Oh, that is. Actually, I got that from the Lion, the newspaper. Yeah, yeah. But in fact, the Lion. I mean, I think in the collections that Agnes was mentioning at the beginning, you can get the Lion. It was one of the most brilliant muckraking attack. Pieces of journalism in that period. Yeah, and so that, in fact, there was a massive parade in Manchester in the early 1830s where adults and children were campaigning against children working in the factories. And they had massive posters. They walked around the streets holding these banners. And there was Blinko's image on dozens of these. And he was there, he was part of the... he really did become the poster boy for this movement. Yes, seconds.
So if the mill owners went to the workhouses and they bought up, young women,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
This would have been just about the time that slavery was out, right?
Yeah, this coincides with the debates about slavery.
I mean, we think of that mostly that, out there in the Atlantic.
Yeah. They were called the white slaves. And people like Richard Carlyle, one of their chief arguments was that you, particularly conservative politicians, are campaigning against slavery in the colonies and yet tolerating this appalling slavery within your own kingdom. And, of course, there are very, very important differences between slavery and this. But, I mean, you take somebody like Robert Blinko and the other... Well, let's take the other children, because he didn't have... any family, he never found them. Many of these children were crippled as a result of accidents in these early factories. But there was no way they could go back to St. Pancras because they had what was called a settlement in Nottingham or Derbyshire. So they basically just lived out their lives on parish aid in parishes that deeply resented their presence. People who couldn't help but despise them because they were imperiling the economic welfare of all the poor families in these places who were having to pay rates. So they lived lives of incredible loneliness, and they were never able to see their families again. So there are very strong overlaps here between slavery and this. The big difference, of course, is that they got their freedom at 21. But in many cases, they were crippled at this point, and frequently they would have died in their later 20s from disease. Yeah, thank you.